Please, let's continue with the next block of our reflections, which are the presentations on the basis of the call for papers Miguel organized with the scientific committee. And we are lucky to have an important number of young scholars who were interested in. And the first one, with a presentation of about 10 minutes, is Emil Zitzke of the University of the Witherden School in Johannesburg. Please.
Thank you so much to the conference organizers for allowing me to speak at this event. It's undoubtedly undeserved goodness to be given this opportunity. Now, I've got 10 minutes to present a 9,000-word paper. So I suggest that we all be responsible tort lawyers for the next 10 minutes and fasten our seatbelts, because this is going to be a very fast ride. South Africa offers a unique southern perspective on tort law reform in the sense that our South African private law is largely uncodified. Most of South African tort law would be encapsulated in the source of law that we call common law, that is judge-made law that has its roots in Roman Dutch law, with some English sprinkles added along the way, developed by our courts over time to meet the needs of the changing South African society. Our legislature has introduced a small handful of statutory torts, but that's definitely the exception rather than the rule. So what is the current feeling about tort law reform in South Africa and the need for some type of statutory intervention in our tort law? All the scholars that form part of the delict canon in South Africa today would regard codification as being unnecessary. The gist of the argument is that the common law's general elements for liability would be flexible enough to accommodate changing circumstances, and so as society changes, the common law simply is applied to the new circumstances, and by those means, there's no need for radical statutory intervention. This is especially so because we have a constitution with very strong horizontality provisions that empower our courts explicitly to develop the common law in rather robust ways, much more definitively so compared to many other jurisdictions. So some people might be concerned about the fact that this gives too much power to the courts, but I think our constitutional drafters definitely had a juristocracy of some kind in mind when they drafted the constitution. And that is, of course, in part because of our apartheid history. Apartheid was perpetrated by the executive working in concert with the legislature. Very often it was our judiciary trying to push back against the oppressive laws of the apartheid regime with varying degrees of success, but ultimately there were no testing powers against the legislature at the time. So when the constitutional democracy was introduced in South Africa in the early 1990s, the excitement was very much there for judges to be able to step into the fullness of the role of being testers of the law. Currently, I suppose, part of the hidden reason that might be influencing tort law scholars' perspective that our law should not be codified is that our parliament is in a rather chaotic state, not always doing their job as they should, lots of political grandstanding, with very little to show for it. So we have had the two major sources of law reform being the judiciary and also, in a few select cases, the legislature. When it comes to judicial law reform, our developments are supposed to be constitutionally informed in each and every case, and our courts very often rely on foreign legal systems to make these developments. Usually it's the English-speaking world that they would rely on, so the UK, New Zealand, Australia, Canada, and so forth, but also in some select instances, the European Union as well. Some of the judicial law reforms that have been brought about have been serious interventions in the context of wrongful omissions for state liability, vicarious liability, changing and introducing more tests to determine factual causation, and so on. On the front of defamation, our courts have introduced fault-based liability for the media after a long period of strict liability under apartheid censorship. The courts have also introduced remedies to deal with the removal of internet-based defamation, and they've introduced apologies as a remedy for defamation as well. They've more recently introduced new defenses to help those on the receiving end of slap suits, so the strategic litigation against public participation. People who are accused in those cases would be able to have new recourse now. The evaluation of the judicial reforms that have been brought about, generally very well received by academics. I would say probably about 98% of the reviews have been five stars for all the developments that have been brought about. But for those of us who are more analytically inclined, you very often see a select few criticisms that arise against some of these judicial interventions, very often because the courts are so focused on getting the outcome of the case right that sometimes they struggle to justify working with the common law as it stands to get it to the point of giving the right outcome. And so the way that I like to describe it is that our courts are sometimes criticized for thinking outside of the box too quickly before they've convinced us that they know what is inside of the box first. On the front of statutory reform, there have been three major interventions. We created a statutory tort of hate speech. Now, the common law in South Africa did recognize a claim for so-called objectively offensive insult, but the legislature clearly wanted to introduce a tort that could protect the dignity of groups, especially after apartheid. In the statute, they also included a unique set of remedies, like paying compensation to an organization of some kind that would represent the interests of the group and some other ideas as well. Now, the original version of the statute that created the tort of hate speech was taken to the Constitutional Court on review on account of it being written really poorly. So on the technical front, it was written poorly because they didn't make use of good punctuation. And in the list of requirements, they didn't add and or at the end. So it was just comma, comma, semicolon, the end. And no one really knew whether you would prove one, two, or a selection of them. There was some uncertainty in that regard. In addition to that, the statute was also phrased quite broadly to say that you could succeed with a claim for hate speech based on basically subjective hurt feelings. Which isn't hate speech, of course, that's just hurtful speech. And so the court had to grapple with that and the impact that that would have on freedom of expression. So the Constitutional Court rose to the challenge and fixed the poor drafting and clarified that the tort should really be about hate speech at the end of the day, with an and at the end of the list of requirements, just to be clear. So what we see here is that when the legislature tried to make a new tort here, of course, with the best intentions, the courts actually ended up doing the real reformatory work in the end. So it makes one wonder whether it's really a statutory form of tort law reform at all. The second big statutory intervention dealt with product liability. So our property damage rules have historically allowed for product liability, of course, but under the influence of developments in the United States and the European Union, the legislature decided to introduce a consumer protection statute, including a few sections on product liability. Now, some generous commentators have described these provisions as being particularly complex, but the defenders of truth have said that the sections are in a total state of shambles. There are contradictory definitions, conflated definitions, and contradictory rules that in the end actually do away with the idea of strict liability that the statute ostensibly tries to introduce. So as a joke, I will say that this is what happens perhaps when you entrust tort laws reform to contract lawyers and not to the tort lawyers. Now, the statute hasn't reached the Constitutional Court yet, and it's probably unlikely that it would, but the product liability rules do not inspire much confidence in the legislature's ability to do meaningful tort law drafting reform. So we do have a Data Protection Act that was also introduced. This was in line, basically, with the European Union's Data Protection Directive, and we introduced this statute with a civil liability clause with certain unique remedies, for example, introducing the concept of aggravated damages into South African law that we did not have before. The data protection law reform project was spearheaded by a famous tort lawyer, so the statute is, of course, perfect. I could find no academic commentaries criticizing the civil liability provisions, and I do think that it was drafted really coherently in terms of definitions, provisions, and remedies as well. We haven't really relied on soft law at all, because we don't have any soft law to rely on, except if we would rely on yours. But I think there's definitely scope for research into this area for the South African development community and the African Union. And so for the prospects of reform in South Africa by codification as a whole, I think the current prevailing feeling among tort law scholars is that we don't need it. And also there's Parliament's ostensible inability to legislate effectively in this area that also does not exactly inspire confidence. But perhaps the encouragement that I take from the discussions here today is that if tort law scholars really get involved in the process, there are some prospects for better success. I'm hopeful that in South Africa we can put all the tort lawyers in one room and no torts would be committed in that process. So I am quite hopeful to see what the future might hold in that regard. So I think codification for South Africa could potentially create some opportunities to think more proactively about future problems related to tort's interaction with new technologies like AI, etc. Perhaps even to think about what a truly African tort law might look like, and potentially also what a proper balance between constitutional rights and private law doctrine could be. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for this excellent presentation. And I invite Christian Banfi, Alberto Pino, and Ignacio Rios from Chile to join us here for a presentation. You two colleagues are not present. You two colleagues
yeah,
are not.
Yeah, it's just me.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay, fine. So you have the floor.
It's just me, yeah. Well, thank you, everyone. Thank you, Martin, for inviting me.
For accept my paper, and Maria for accepting the older version of my PowerPoint. Well, the paper that I presented on the presentation seek to provide a novel overview of Latin American tort law, highlighting the opportunities and challenges of implementing a potential project of harmonizing tort law in Latin America. It describes also three common features identifying the literature that distinguish Latin America from other regions, also seeking to avoid misconceptions or oversimplifications that obscure any analysis of Latin America. And then the paper and the presentation present the challenges of systematized tort law and discussed reciprocal influence between countries in Latin America. In honor of the time, I cannot provide more analysis about the opportunities and challenge from harmonization tort law in Latin America. Just let me see two things. First, of course, the main mechanism to systematize tort law in Latin America is codification, but we don't have an internal market like European tort law or contract law. For this reason, we are not. We don't have the incentive to make a code of a Latin American civil code. So in general, we try to identify in the literature and also in each country. Don't forget that Latin America is about 21 countries and South America is 12. A kind of doctrinal codification. That means that the systematization of tort law in general is provided by manuals and treatises for the doctrine for legal scholar. So we can approach Latin American law and Latin American tort law from two perspective. One is an optimistic perspective. Kias Rosen in 1971 titled that Latin America is a kind of comparative dream for the great diversity of countries whose legal structure derive from common sources. But the truth is that we have a common pessimistic view about Latin American. And that is, first, there is commonly in the literature provide a pessimistic view of Latin American law, Latin American tort law, as a consequence of absence of legal originality, then an economic irrelevance in general in Latin America, and finally the political instability as a consequence of the dictatorships and lack of democracy context in Latin America. So we can find also in the literature three kind of futures of Latin American, which are quite related with this kind of approach that previously note. First, Roman law pattern or colonialism of Latin American tort law or Latin American law. So many countries in the region have built a legal system on import models. Some authors note that this is a common evolutionary pattern representing for a typical case of legal transplant or reception imposed by colonial powers. However, subsequent codification in Latin American process a kind of voluntary adopt foreign models, full or partial, motivated by the prestige associated by the import model. This is a case of Peru with Italy, for example. There is no doubt that Latin American law is part of the European legal tradition, influenced, as I say, to the significant extent by Roman law, and perhaps, as Professor Winger talked a moment ago, this is probably the reason that there are no initiatives in many Latin American countries to reform the code, the civil code, and also the tort law. First is in Roman law, but also in the French Code Civil and the Siete Partidas, who has very similarities with Roman law. This is an example that you can see the influence of different civil codes on the Latin American countries. Of course, this is an historical scheme, but you can see first the codes that the Latin American codes dependent of French code in part or in full. Then other codes dependent or influenced by the Spanish code. And lastly, but no less important, the codes dependent or influenced by the Chilean Civil Code. The Chilean Civil Code is the third oldest civil code in force, before the French one and the Austrian. Second feature is that Latin American private law is primarily based on civil law tradition, whether as a part of his own legal system or an alternative variant of his tradition. There is a discussion about the topic or the debate of legal families. Although this there is an influence or parallel expansion also in private law, but in some context on property law, not in tort law, for the trust, the institution of trust from the United States. And of course, as Professor Martin explained, we don't have the doctrine of precedent, so the case law is not a source of law. And finally, we have, as probably every know, a political and an institutional instability. Latin American has been characterized by frequent political upheavals, from the fight for independence to the oscillation between democratic governments and dictatorships. Of course, this have impacted the development of legal system. So the initial assumption that Latin American law is a variant of European system is quickly disproven. because the reality is that there is a pattern of, as mentioned Esquirol, a pattern of lax legal enforcement, significant operational shortcoming, and pervasive corruption. And the combination of these factors result in a chronic failure of legal system. Probably this explains also that the political debate on Latin American countries is more like, as Matt mentioned, in other kind of reforms. For example, you may know that Chile has three kind of intents of new constitution. And in constitutional theory, you can see a kind of doctrine of what is the exact constitutional moment to have a new constitution. So, at least in many Latin American countries, not a kind of not a priority to have a kind of a new code or legislative. A new initiative to change tort law and civil code. Okay, but what happened with that? We have, if we see the three characteristics or features of Latin American tort law, the problem with that is, I would say, we have two problems. First, the analysis, the traditional analysis of Latin American rules according depends on the perspective of the observer. For example, if you talk with an Italian background civil professor, they talk about this this situation, and of course there is a lack of comparative law manuals from an external view. And of course, the external observer have this risk of overlooking or misinterpreting decisive factors. What is the reciprocal Latin American influence? And with this the next slide, I finish. We identify these ones. We identify cases of Latin American identity. The first case is the trend towards punitive damage, and the second case is loss of a chance. We can see that in both cases, there are foreign doctrines that are incorporated into Latin American countries, so this could how the identity of Latin America is permeated by foreign doctrines even now. And then, what is the influence of Latin American scholarship on Chilean law? These are the three kind of topic, and this is quite exclusive because in Chile and in Latin America, we don't tend to see the neighborhoods. In general, we see the other kind of bigger countries, and these three cases, we try to see the what is the development on other Latin American countries. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. You were for three persons, so
yeah,
we should have given three times the time for speakers, but thank you very much for your presentation. Now, Andre Pereira will be online or not?
Hello, my name is Rui Cascão. We agreed, me and Andre agreed that I would make the bulk of the presentation and he will wrap it up. So first of all, I'd like to thank the organization for accepting our paper and for all of the patience. We were not able to be present in Girona. So here it goes. We are going to make a scathing critique of the Portuguese liability law, of the Portuguese tort liability law, insofar as medical liability is concerned. The Portuguese legal system is complex, fragmented, lengthy, unpredictable, and largely undercompensates patients. Different legal rules and judicial venues mean that medical adverse events are adjudicated differently, and this usually goes to detriment of the aggrieved party. we think that this fragmentation is a breach of the international obligations assumed by Portugal, in particular as regards the European Convention on Human Rights, and in particular Article 24 of the Council of Europe's Oviedo Convention on Human Rights and Biomedicine. Portugal has been already convicted in several cases, in several decisions of the European Court of Human Rights for breach of some of the rights therein protected as regards medical liability. Excessive length, breach of the right to life in its procedural dimension, etc. The Portuguese healthcare system can be characterized as a beverage system. So there's a national healthcare service that provides public healthcare, and this is the bulk of healthcare provided in Portugal. There's also, of course, private healthcare providers that complement or compete with the national healthcare system. It is a fault-based system, unlike, for instance, Scandinavian countries that made away with tort, or Lithuania in that respect, or even France or Belgium that have mechanisms, that have legal systems that combine fault-based liability with some sort of compensation, no-fault compensation for some risks. One of the issues about Portuguese liability law in respect to healthcare is that what we call, what we refer to as fragmentation, is that if healthcare is provided by a private provider, it will be framed in contract and or tort. So the most of the doctrine and most of the case law considers that they overlap, that there's a cumul of both regimes, contract liability and tort liability. Of course, the problem there afterwards is to what extent. There are different trends in case law and in legal opinion. Some of them consider that there's not a significant difference besides the prescription, the limitation periods. Whereas some others consider that wrongfulness still needs to be proved by the plaintiff, whereas fault is presumed when it's considered to be contractual liability. And in some, for some authors and some case law, the whole debate introduced by René de Moog about obligations of means and obligation of results will lead to different decisions in different courts regarding the same type of injury. This is further complicated by when healthcare is provided in the context of the National Healthcare Service. If the provider is public, then it is considered as an acta iure imperii and therefore committed to the administrative court system. So then it will be not the regular court, but the administrative courts will entertain jurisdiction over these cases, and state liability applies. And this excludes tort and its contractual liability. Now, the administrative justice track is infamous for the excessive length of its proceedings. This had led to many, many condemnations by the European Court of Human Rights. For instance, Valada Matos das Neves versus Portugal, delay of 9 years in adjudication. Lopes Sousa Fernandes versus Portugal, violation of the procedural limb of Article 2 of the European Convention on Human Rights. It took over 10 years for the administrative justice system to reach a final decision. And there again, it will be more difficult to, for the plaintiff to demonstrate liability, to prove fault, wrongfulness, causation, and damage in an administrative court than in a regular court. So it is a system that is complex, fragmented, lengthy, unpredictable, and generally undercompensates patients. It also treats patients that have suffered essentially similar damage in a different way. And we consider that this system is deeply unfair and illogical. It is a damages lottery, using the borrowing the words of Patrick Attia, and we deserve better. There was a missed chance in 2019, when the new basic law on healthcare was being drafted. The first draft had provision on compensation of unreasonable damage, and within a reasonable time, and the government would be charged to regulate medical liability. Unfortunately, this did not go through to the final draft of this basic law, and it was not reflected in the law that was finally approved in 2019, Law 95-2019. Wrapping it up, for a long time, Professor André Pereira, me, and all of our colleagues at the Center for Biomedical Law of the University in Coimbra, we have been striving to have a clear legal regime on medical law, liability regime on medical law, contemplating fair compensation for medical injury pursuant to Article 24 of the Oviedo Convention, a centralized one-stop-shop liability of healthcare institution, a shift from fault to risk as a key criterion for entitlement to compensation in certain exceptional circumstances, in particular hospital-acquired, hospital-associated infections, systemic organizational malfunctioning in healthcare organizations, gross negligence, or the deployment of artificial intelligence systems, and preferential resort to extrajudicial resolution of disputes. Why can't the legal system evolve? Why is it so difficult to have a reform of the liability system? I'd say status quo bias, institutional reasons, deeply entrenched in the legal system, a fear of the risks related to the financial liabilities that would emerge from shifting the paradigm for medical liability compensation, and, of course, the lobbies. I don't know if André has anything to add to what I've said. If I see that Professor André rests, and so thank you very much for your attention and for your patience.
Thank you much. Thank you very much for your presentation. And we jump on to the next person, Rekha Pushtaili from the University of Miskolc in Hungary. Please. Pardon me.
Thank you very much. It works. Okay. So first of all, I'm very grateful for being here today, in this splendid conference. I've got so much inspiring thoughts and ideas. So as an exchange, please let me give some insight into the Hungarian Civil Code, the tort law questions, focusing on today the strict liability for highly dangerous activities. First, The Hungarian civil codes always follow the legislative approach to provide for one general rule for liability for highly dangerous activities. Despite the fact that the general fault-based liability rule is one of the most general tort law provisions ever drafted, and its functions with a general reversed burden of proof and objective concept of fault, the strict liability rule is even more attractive to the claimants, provided that all its conditions have been met. Besides its strictness, this abstract norm not only leaves the types of activities to be deemed as highly dangerous undefined, but also leaves the concept of the operator open, and likewise leaves the scope of activity undetermined. In practice, one can observe cases of liability for activities involving gradually decreasing level of risk. The new civil code established a rather strict liability regime for contractual liability as well. You can see the tripartite set of conditions, which grants a relatively hard set of rules for exemption from liability, the contractual liability. The claims for consequential losses are limited to the foreseeable ones, and the contracting parties may also agree upon limitation of liability. Parallelly, it introduces the so-called non-cumul principles, so that means it excludes the liability, the claims for liability based on non-contractual, so the ritual causes. This rule emerged without precedence in the Hungarian system and against the generally accepted principle of concurrence of action. The main objective was to promote the risk allocation function of the contract, the guard the contractual freedom, and the priority of the contractual clauses. However, contrary to the French and the Romanian civil code, the Hungarian one lacks any provision further clarifying the limits of the applicability of this rule. The judicial practice and the legal literature by now provided some handrails. But first, I would like to highlight how the non-cumul rule generates or will generate significant changes in statutory rules with the example of product liability. Judith Fazekas also warned us that in the case of concurrence between product liability and contractual liability rules, the non-cumul principle should not undermine the application of the harmonized EU liability regime. The direct and remarkable impact of the introduction of the non-cumul rule on the strict liability in tort was the decreasing number of lawsuits and disappearing types of cases. And after a flourishing decade or two of the indemnification cases emerged from, for example, services with extreme recreational activities from after 2000. In this regard, one can observe a limiting, obfuscating effect on the protection of high values, such as life and bodily integrity, and on the risk allocation function of the risk-based liability rule. As the non-cumul rule deprives the injured person of the possibility to base his claim for damages on the strict liability rule for highly dangerous activity, its risk allocation function, which also includes a compensation zone without fault, may disappear or would disappear in the cases where this function differs from the contractual risk allocating function subjected to the conditions of the contractual liability. Analyzing the case law, I would like to show a return to the substantive evaluation of the state of fact as if it would be based on the liability for highly dangerous activity, moving to the approach to the Anspruch, Norm, and Concurrence, the competing basis of the claim, or maybe the emerging cases, which is the Einheitsanspruch, and also putting some limits on the applicability of the non-cumul rule. How? You can see four steps here. I would like to highlight three of them. The first condition was establishing the breach of contract. We agree with Adam Fuglinski's observation that the mere occurrence of the serious bodily injuries established the fact that the recreational facilities were proven to be not safe, and consequently, the operator must breach the contract. The second condition is whether he can be exonerated from liability. According to the new civil code advisory body, An internal cause beyond human control is not considered to be a cause outside of scope of control. Therefore, the examination of the other exonerative conditions has become essentially pointless. Regarding the gratuitous contract, as cases also emerged from organized public transport, some judicial fora already ruled that the principle of non-cumul is not to be applied in cases of free transport. One can consider it as a contra legem interpretation. Lastly, in my opinion, the principle of non-cumul may also bring some positive outcomes in the borderline of ultra-hazardous activities. Where the contractual relationship established, the service provider is obliged to fulfill all obligation to protect the other party's interests. Doing so, other damaging causes would be covered, not only those that are connected to the ultra-hazardous activity, so there is no need to expand the scope of the dangerous activity or the dangerousness to cover these duties, as done before, for example, in case of the accident due to the slippery bus stop. Under the old civil code, the judicial practice elaborated the notion of the operator. As you can see here, the operator, not here, just only one dimension. The operator is the person who maintains and operates continuously the hazardous operation, who exerts power of disposal, and who determines when and how it functions. The new civil code defines only one dimension and formulated as so. The person is whose interest the hazardous operation are carried out shall be considered as an operator. I would like here only stress the importance of the appropriate interpretation. What does it mean, interest? Because, as in my opinion, it is refers or reflects the principle of active interest. Let me show you only one case, so-called Kid Quad case, which challenged almost all of the subject and concept considering highly dangerous activities. The first. You can see challenge there. What does it mean? Highly dangerous activity. Who is the operator? How works the work the rules on collision of dangerous operations? And also challenge the interpretation of the contributory conduct. In this case, a 7-year-old child had a quad for children with a combustion engine, 3 gears, and a speed of maximum 40 kilometers per hour. One day, his father and one of the father's friends went out to jumping motors on the hilly terrain, and he accompanied them with his kid quad. Before performing a risky jumping, the friend asked the child's father to take care of and supervise his child. Because of the father's negligence, the friend spotted the child too late and could not have avoided the collision. The child's injuries were extremely serious and permanent. Both the child and his parents asserted claims for damages. The courier confirmed that using this type of quad is a highly dangerous activity. In addition, it successfully evaded the conceptual problem of regarding this child as an operator. The courier held the father liable for as an operator. Having decided so, both operators' faulty conduct became directly comparable. However, this fact only impacted the father's claim, since, as a rule, both operators' blameworthy conduct relating to the highly dangerous activities can be commensurated. As far as the child's claim is concerned, his contributory conduct was irrelevant according to the former judicial practice, and also according to new civil code. Nevertheless, the new civil code provides for the operator for a claim for reimbursement against the carer, the supervisor, and will create a clearer and fair situation in cases such as the above cited one. And lastly, I would like to highlight only some restructuring between the strict liability rules. You can see here in the former civil code contains only one rule, keepers of animals with wide by nature, and the keepers of animals was liable as a highly dangerous activities operator. You can see now we have two rules for that, but after that the act of wild game on wild game remained and retained the rule, the coalition rule is continuously applied in this situation. Because of the serious concern and problems with the application, consequently in 2023 and 2024, great amendments targeted these coalition rule, and this article in this Wild Game Act contains now special deeming provisions and other rules. So my time's up. Thank you very much for my attention.
Thank you very much for your contribution. And I invite Stefano Gatti of the University of Verona.
So, good afternoon. I'm Stefano Gatti, researcher at the University of Verona. First of all, I would like to thank Professor Casals, the organizer of the scientific committee, for this wonderful conference and for giving me the opportunity to present in this prestigious context. So I'm really grateful. In Western legal system, it's usually emphasized that the civil wrong, a tort, cannot be the occasion for profit for the tortfeasor. However, civil codes very rarely include private law remedies that directly target the profit made by the wrongdoer. So the question could be, why? First, the profit gained from wrongdoing is often considered by public law rules, such as criminal law. Several public enforcement rules in Europe now expressly consider financial benefits gained by the infringer as a parameter to assess administrative fines to be imposed on those who violate the EU law. Just think about the EU directive, so-called Omnibus Directive on Consumer Rights of 2019. In all these cases, the money taken from the wrongdoer, from the tortfeasor, is paid into the public coffers and not into the pockets of the tort victim. In addition, as far as private law is concerned, the recovery of profit in favor of the tort victim requires a legal basis. Otherwise, the victim's enrichment would be unjustified. The deterrent effect of taking away from the wrongdoer the gain obtained through a wrongdoing is unquestionable. However, by the logic of private law, that's not enough to ground the infringer's obligation to disgorge profits. One of the most common ideas also represented in the DCFR is that the disgorgement of profits could embody an alternative way to compensate the plaintiff for damages. However, in European law, the general way to compensate victims of wrongdoing is to restore them to a situation of indifference from the wrongdoing itself. Even in cases where the damages are difficult to ascertain, as it happens for non-pecuniary loss or lost profits as well, the focus should always be on the victim's position and not that of the tortfeasor. In the absence of general private law provisions, the topic maybe can be approached by analyzing specific private law rules that target the wrongdoer's profit. Some of them are outlined in the intellectual property law, especially following the harmonization brought by the Enforcement Directive, Directive number 48 of 2004. In this field, wrongful acts consist of usurping protected assets and typically do not lead to compensable damages for victims or cause, at least cause damages that are really difficult to prove. Article 13 of the Enforcement Directive offers two perspectives from which the infringer's profit can emerge in a private law logic. On the one hand, they are exceptionally considered as a parameter for quantifying damages that national courts can take into account. On the other hand, the infringer profits may become the subject of a specific measure which member states can set forth in their national legal systems. According to Article 13, paragraph 2, the victim may seek, instead of compensation, the recovery of profits made by the wrongdoer. In implementing this provision, the Italian legislator has introduced the so-called reversione degli utili, disgorgement of profits, which the plaintiff can claim regardless of the extent of the damage he or she has suffered. This remedy is based on three requirements. The wrongdoer has violated the plaintiff's rights by usurping an intangible asset belonging to him or her. The wrongdoer gained a profit because of that. And there's a link between the profit and the violation. The reversione degli utili, according to the Corte di Cassazione, the Italian Supreme Court, has a restitutionary, not punitive function. Accordingly, profit must be recovered regardless of the wrongdoer's fault and only to the strict extent that it results from the usurpation of the victim's right. Disgorgement of profits represents a new remedy under Italian law and is inspired, so to say, by unjust enrichment, arricchimento senza causa, but not to be confused with that. The arricchimento senza causa, unjust enrichment, logically requires an impoverishment under Italian law of the plaintiff, and it's limited in its extent to that value. Therefore, profits realized by the infringer fall outside scope of application. While waiting for an organic reform of tort-related restitution, what interpreters maybe can do is try to extend, by analogy, the restituzione degli utili, the disgorgement of profits, to other cases of usurpation of assets that have the same characteristics as Italian property, as intellectual property rights, in particular the intangible nature. In a case-by-case analysis, two fields of private law seem relevant to me, consumer protection and data, personal data protection. Concerning B2C relationships, emblematic cases of profitable wrongs are unfair terms and unfair business practices. Concerning unfair terms, the ECJ has recently emphasized that consumer protection rules shall deter sellers and suppliers from including those terms in their contract with consumers. A recent decision, Bank M, has ruled out that deterrence could provide a sufficient legal basis for imposing on businesses the disgorgement of profits gained thanks to an unfair term. However, according to DCJ, member states are free to lay down this remedy in their national law as long as it complies with the principle of proportionality. Taking Italian law as an example, a disgorgement of profits in this case is not appropriate. There is no room for an application by analogy of the reversione degli utili, which covers profits generated from intangible assets. There is no room for the reversione degli utili, even in the field of unfair commercial or unfair business practices. In this case, the infringer's profits derive from the choice of the targeted consumers to refrain from reacting in order to avoid effort and cost of legal action. So in these cases, that happens because the damages suffered are often very low, Streuschaden. However, this problem can be addressed by enhancing the synergy between private and public enforcement remedies. Private law remedies, including compensation for damages, can be exercised through class actions and representative actions whose scope of application has been recently extended in national and EU legislation. Furthermore, in a blind spot, using Rodolfo Sacco's word, that tort law cannot penetrate, public enforcement become crucial. That's the reason why supervisory authorities are allowed to consider financial benefits as parameters for quantifying fines. Concerning personal data protection, the relevant framework is laid down in the GDPR. The GDPR does not provide rules for quantifying compensation, meaning that national rules will apply. Still, damages awards under Article 82 of the GDPR must be intended, according to the ECJ, to fully compensate the data subject for the damage suffered because of the infringement. Punitive damages are therefore not allowed. Moving from this legal framework, the first question is whether a disgorgement remedy under national law would be compatible with the legal unification imposed by an EU regulation. I think that the answer could be yes. Disgorgement of profits should be framed in the law of restitution. This remedy, as explained, has nothing to do with compensating for damages or punishing the wrongdoer, but instead share a similar nature as unjust enrichment. Regarding Italian law, the legal basis for such a remedy could be the reversione degli utili. The contemporary market shows that data are assets that can be commercially exploited, even though they are at the same time expression of the data subject's personality. On a practical level, the main difficulty could be when an infringement occurs, many data subjects are involved, and the value of data depends on its aggregation into big data. So it's difficult to determine the extent to which an individual's information has contributed to generating the company's profit. For this reason, on the one hand, the role of collective protection is crucial. On the other hand, public enforcement rules are crucial as well. Concluding remarks. From a private law perspective, the law of restitution is the most appropriate field for targeting the infringer's profit. As in many other legal systems, Italy has not developed a remedy of general scope. According to its restitutionary basis, the reversione degli utili can be applied only in limited cases. In different cases, it would have a punitive purpose, which is alien to private law, according to my view. And this explains why it's so difficult in Europe to shape a general disgorgement remedy. And this is also the reason why, in order to make the tort does not pay, public enforcement rules are really relevant as well. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much for your presentation. And I invite Can Yildirim and Arikan Karisha from the University of Kadiri Ash. Please.
First of all, I would like to thank the Scientific Committee for giving us this great opportunity. My colleague Kaan Can Yıldırım and I examine whether the recent Turkish product liability reform succeeded and how legislative activities impacted on this outcome. In Turkey, before 2003, judicial decisions regulated product liability. During this period, the courts reversed the burden of proof of fault in favor of the injured party. Between 2003 and 2013, legislators made several amendments to consumer protection law to establish a product liability regime. However, critics argued against these amendments and they did not become common practice. In 2013, the new consumer protection law excluded regulations on product liability. Therefore, it became clear that the consumer laws no longer address this issue. After a long legislative process, the adoption of the Product Safety and Technical Regulations Code in 2020 introduced a specific and explicit product liability regime into Turkish law. The preamble to Article 6 of the Code, which regulates liability, states that the underlying regulation is the EU Product Liability Directive. However, there are both similarities and major differences between the directive and the code. I would like to highlight the most important of these differences. The most fundamental difference arises on the basis of liability. While the directive bases liability on the fact of the concept of defect, the code bases liability on the concept of nonconformity. The code defines nonconformity as the failure of the product to comply with the technical standards, technical regulations, or the general safety legislation. Another important difference between the code and the directive relates to the possibility of the exemption from liability. Perhaps the most significant difference in this regard is the development risk defense. Because the code does not allow the producer to exempt itself from liability based on the development risk defense. The statute of limitation period is another important difference. The most notable difference between the two provisions concerns the 10-year period. In the code, this 10-year period starts with the occurrence of the damage, while according to the directive, this period starts from the date product is placed on the market. Under the directive, the period is which for the producer may be liable is much more precise and predictable. Additionally, in the adopted product liability directive proposal, the definition of the product includes softwares, whereas the code does not include softwares. To summarize, the code allows the producer to exempt from liability if it produces its product in accordance with the minimum technical standards. This means that under the code, the producer will often not be held liable. Even if the producer is held liable, it can argue that the regulation in the code is far from establishing a fair balance between the parties. Due to these deviations, it can be said that the code, not fully in harmony with the principles of the product liability and the European Union product liability regime. On the other hand, in Turkish law, the judges have wide power of discretion under the Turkish Civil Code. This discretion allows the judges to interpret the provisions of the code in accordance with the principles of the product liability and the product liability directive. Thus, we can expect that the decisions will develop product liability in Turkish law in the coming years. Now, I would like to leave the floor to my colleague, Kaan Yıldırım.
I'm Kaan Yıldırım, and I will take over from here for the next couple of minutes. As my colleague mentioned, there has been a long-standing effort actually on product liability in Turkish law. Legislator is engaged for the last couple of decades. Courts are engaged, scholars are engaged, and despite this, we still haven't been able to achieve the desired level in product liability that complies with the needs of the modern world. It seems possible to achieve this level actually within with the help of the other legal instruments that my colleague mentioned earlier, but this is not the subject of our research. We examine why these flaws stand out in the first place. And when we examined this, when we go through the parliamentary documents, commission minutes, we found out that we can trace them back to the legislative body and how the legislative functions. So the legislative process has perhaps the greatest impact on tort reform, regardless of the quality and the quantity of the intellectual work done, the research done. At the end of the day, legislator is the body that brings about the tort law reform. So we cannot oversee its influence on the success of a tort reform. When we examine this process, we found out these setbacks. So drafting period actually started in 2013 and it lasted almost a decade. And in these 7 years, we had 7 elections, so almost once a year. Not all of them are technical elections, but we needed to vote once a year almost. This has some of course, influence at the legislative functions. So first of these is that the efforts were interrupted many times because of these political reasons, such as change of government, change of governmental system, constitutional amendments. These all affected the process, and it interrupted many times, almost once a year. And as a result, the legislative process is characterized by a sense of urgency, which can even be referred to as a rush. And another flaw is that the lack of the effective debate environment because of these elections and because of the Turkey's general political atmosphere, we can see in the commission reports and the parliamentary debates that discussions are often interrupted by political matters. In addition to that, traces of the relations and tensions between political parties are also easily traceable in the documents. It also appears that the involvement of the external parties, such as NGOs and legal scholars, were only possible to a limited extent, which affected the outcomes, of course. And when we analyze the sources of these flaws or these setbacks, one aspect in particular stands out: the social agenda and the political environment of the country. So the legislative activities are, by their very nature, influenced by social needs and agendas. And as I mentioned before, the political atmosphere in Turkey is often intense, and this is reflected in the parliamentary activities. And due to these thought studies that can be considered relatively insignificant and have a lower social response, remained in the background. And as Professor Winiger and Professor Koch mentioned earlier, in the absence of a public interest or pressure, legislators tend to abandon these kind of reforms. So despite the academic interest and efforts in the subject in the last 5-6 decades, it is evident that the impact of social dynamics and events on the legislative process is quite high in the emergence of this negative result. And this reveals that for tort law reforms to succeed, the intellectual or scientific work done prior is not alone at utmost important. The legislative body and the legislative structure and the social body has to be in a shape that allows to reflect this intellectual and scientific done prior. So since legislative activities are also very vulnerable to being influenced by the social structure, it is essential that the social situation is at a point that allows for the preparation of a successful reform. I would like to thank once again on behalf of my colleague as well, the scientific committee and the organizing committee for making it possible for us to be here. And thank you all for your time.
Thank you very much for your double intervention. And now I invite a trio composed by Witold Borysiak from the University of Warsaw, by Andrea Parziale from the University of Maastricht, and Hélène Guizou de l'Université Paris-Panthéon-Assas. As you know, certainly, the rules of the game is simple. You are a trio, and each one of you has 10 minutes to present its purpose in the form of tableau. Please, who wants to start?
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Benedict. Fine. And I also will start my own watch here. This is a plan of my presentation. Thank you very much for the possibility to present the topic of standardization of claims for non-pecuniary damages in Polish law. Short introduction, legislative changes in Polish law, and then impact on the damages for non-pecuniary laws, initial attempts, further attempts at the standardization, and the creation of the database to standardize the bereavement claims. Very short introduction, because until June 2023, we haven't got anything. It means that we know private collections of court judgments or any database that gave the possibility for judges and for the injured parties to find the proper solution. What is the proper amount in the personal injury cases? Of course, it's created a lot of problems, mainly for the judges and also for the injured party to establish the proper amount of compensation. At the beginning of the 21st century, we started to change our tort law. I will be very, very concise in this topic, mainly because Eva Baginska already mentioned that, and I have only 10 minutes. At the beginning, Polish law, new bereavement claims in the 1933 Clause of Obligations. Those claims were abandoned mainly for extraordinary reasons, mainly because they were contrary to so-called socialist morality. And there was the main reason to abandon them. It was the common opinion of the jurisprudence during that time. And of course, after the changes in the 1990s, Polish jurisprudence decided to establish family bond as a personality right, and infringement of this bond created the ground for compensation. I've already mentioned that, but in 2008 we had this reform which reintroduced the bereavement claims to the Polish Civil Code. This is new Article 446, Section 4, but this amendment did not solve the problem of family bond as personality rights, mainly in the cases, very important cases, when accident led to the victim's serious and permanent bodily injury. There was a problem in jurisprudence in that field, and it created a lot of problems and diverge judgments of even in the Supreme Court, because two different chambers of the Polish Supreme Court, civil chamber in 2018, there were three judgments from 2018, all of them in the panel of seven judges, very important panel, which said that this is the ground for compensation, the family bond is personality rights. And there was a chamber for extraordinary control and public accounts established after the changes of the government in 2016. And the judgment also, panel of seven judges in 2019 said that family bond is not a personality right, there is no compensation in such a situation. And because of that, this was also already mentioned by Eva, in 2021, Poland decided to award compensation to the victim's closest family members in those cases when we have the victim is still alive, but there is but he's in a vegetative state or there's a serious bodily injury. And on top of that, we started the initial attempts at the standardization of damages for non-pecuniary loss. They were initiated mainly by the Polish Ministry of Justice, but they were preceded by the research into court files did by the Institute of Justice. This is a special unit of the Ministry of Justice who works on the case files, but also make comparative researches. And this was this initiated court file research. And between 2009 and 2010, and then 2012 and 2013, those research projects on court files were did in the Institute of Justice, and there were two main issues that the Institute wanted to check. First, the pecuniary compensation for non-material harm in the cases of personal injury, and the death of the close family member bereavement claim, this article, new article 446, section 4 of the Polish Civil Code. You may see here those reports from 2010-2011 made by the Institute of Justice. What are the trends observed in those surveys? Very interesting one. First, the damages differ depending on the size and location of the courts. It is very interesting because, for example, the courts in Warsaw tend to award greater compensation than the courts on the east side of Poland. The second, also very interesting observation, when the district courts are the highest, the first instance courts, they are the highest courts, they tend to award higher compensation for the same damage than regional courts when they are the courts of the first instance in Poland. The third thing, the lack of standardization creates the so-called underreporting of compensation paid by insurers at the pre-litigation stage. It means the injured party don't know what is the proper amount, an insurer can offer them anything what they want. And fourth observation, where the injured party has a legal representation, barrister, suitor, higher levels of compensation are awarded. This is also a very interesting observation. And since 2015, strong demands for the normative standardization of damages for non-pecuniary loss have been made by the Polish National School of Judiciary and Public Prosecution. This is a special school
also this unit of the Ministry of Justice, which aimed to train judges. They said, we need to know what is the proper amount of compensation because we need to train judges and the people who are going to be judges. We need to standardize the damages for non-pecuniary loss. Then, 2016, also Polish Financial Supervision Authority, the authority that controls the financial institutions and also insurers, said clearly, we have some problems on that field. This recommendation, which was issued in 2016, said that we have problems and we need standardization on that field because without it, there's a lot of problems to find a proper solution in this relation between insurer and the injured party. All of those works supposed to be coordinated by the Polish Civil Law Codification Commission. Also, Ewa Bagińska mentioned that, but the dissolution of the Codification Commission 2015, in December, after the change of the government, deprived the Ministry of Justice of the Commission's expert knowledge. We did not have any Codification Commission. And the Ministry of Justice decided, okay, we don't have this commission, we need to find another solution. And they decided to establish so-called Civil Law Legislative Department at the Polish Ministry of Justice. And what the department decided to do? They sort of started with the court fire survey at the Institute of Justice, mainly based on 900 cases, motor vehicle accidents, only motor vehicle accidents also, personal injury claims, and the death of the close family member, so-called bereavement claims. And what were the trends on that survey? Also very interesting ones. Vast majority of cases no longer concern personal injuries, but the bereavement claims based on article or dimension 446, paragraph 4 of the Polish Civil Code. And mainly those cases are involved so-called compensation law companies, private companies for which those claims are the major source of income because of the success fee. Nevertheless, nothing changed. Why? This survey did not result in preparation of the standardization. Maybe because of the changes within the Polish Civil Law Legislative Department. They had some like four directors during the 3 years. And there was lack of political vision. Why? Because the minister was an expert on criminal law, and of course they were mainly wanted to work on criminal law, not on a civil law basis. Fortunately, yes. But in 2022, National School decided to create its own database, which could give the information about the award. And they started to do it with this fire research conducted by the National School of Judiciary and Public Prosecution with a team of experts composed by judges and academics. And they created a database to define such criteria as gender of the claimant, degree of family relationship, husband, wife, concubine, child, grandchild, age of the claimant, age of the deceased. Moreover, it is possible to look at such criteria as whether the deceased child was the claimant-only child, length of marriage and cohabitation, other circumstances, for example, the closeness of the relationship. And you may see here this database from your right side and from my left side, you may see the gender of the claimant, the age of the claimant, the age of the deceased person, common cohabitation, the year of the judgment. In the center, you may see, for example, if this was the only child, the question about the marital status, length of the marriage, prior circumstances, question of the accidents, and of course, this lowest and highest damages, the value of the median, and first and the third quarter. This is in your left side. 300 Polish zloty, the largest amount, is something like 75,000-80,000 euro. And you can also look at the list of cases. If you look at this database, you have here different cases, mainly date of the judgment, fire reference, name of the court, and amount of compensation awarded. Most of those cases are available at the portal of the judgment of the Polish courts. And you may see this link to the judgment. Their cases are available online. They created only also, I'm just finishing, they created also two similar bases. First base for non-pecuniary damages for wrongful imprisonment in criminal cases, the second derived from repressions in the, during the communist times. And coming back to the conclusions, because it's the final time, I just made it in 11 minutes. We have a lot of ideas to implement the standardization. After 10 years of works, we have only one base, very unofficial, limited in scope, and it shows why the torture reform is very difficult and influenced by different reasons. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Witold, and it's on you.
Okay, great. Thank you. So good evening at this point to everyone. First of all, of course, let me express my gratitude to the organizers of the conference for this nice opportunity to share a part of my research on damage standardization in Europe. This is actually not a typical example of my research. It is more of an interdisciplinary incursion at the interface between public choice theory and damage standardization, and it is pretty much still a work in progress. In particular, the manuscript I submitted for this conference applies a public choice framework to the Irish, Italian, and Dutch experiences of standardization of non-pecuniary damages, which were more or less successful. For instance, the Irish initiative for the new personal injury guidelines is a successful example of an attempt at more standardized and lower damages for minor injuries. The Italian experience is a mixed example because it was a it is a successful it is an example of a successful attempt at more standardized and lower damages for minor injuries from traffic accidents and later also medical accidents. But it is also an example of a failed attempt so far at more standardized and lower damages for major injuries, whereas the Dutch experience is an example of a successful reform, the reform of affectieschade, the reform of bereavement damages, which are very rigidly standardized, although it took about 17 years for the Dutch lawmaker to adopt this kind of damages. So these three examples are instances of a more general trend in Europe towards the standardization of non-pecuniary damages, also at the normative level, which means that the quantification of non-pecuniary damages is more and more influenced by normative choices made by the political decision makers. Now, in principle, I think that there is nothing wrong with this, because after all, for non-material losses, we don't have objective quantification criteria, so any quantification decision, be it at the individual or collective level, is, in theory, as arbitrary as it is legitimate. However, I also do believe that if the quantification of these damages becomes the object of standards set normatively at the political level, it is important for to ensure the legitimacy of these political decisions, that these decisions reflect a synthesis of the different interests of all the stakeholders involved, rather than reflect exclusively the interest of one interest group over the others. So to this end, public choice theory provides interesting analytical tools to understand the dynamics of interest groups. Public choice theory is an economic theory that contends that special interest groups shape the law and lobby for changes or for resisting changes in the law so that the law advances their economic interest. So in my manuscript, I rely on the US literature on public choice theory and tort law reform to come up with some expectations, with some hypotheses, with, of course, some adaptations in light of the more European context, which I try to test against the Irish, Italian, and Dutch experiences, which I use as case studies. So a first expectation is that, well, the insurance industry, we've already mentioned this quite often, the insurance industry is a powerful interest group, which is expected to have an interest in pushing for more standardized, more predictable, and ideally maybe lower damages. A second expectation is that lawyers have generally an opposing interest in less standardized and higher damages for, well, economic reasons. And lawyers are more difficult to coordinate themselves, to organize and lobby, but at the same time, they are widely represented in the political arena. There's lots of lawyers in parliaments across Europe. Third expectation, judges, of course, don't have a direct economic stake in the quantification of damages, but sometimes they're expected to be jealous of their discretion. So they may be expected to be skeptical towards more standardized damages. So we can expect them to try to resist these attempts. And once these attempts are successful at the legislative level, we may expect them to try to find ways to work around the standards to award what they actually want. And finally, victims and claimants are just too dispersed to be an effective interest group, although they may have an interest in more personalized and higher damages. So, of course, I don't have the time to go through the case studies in detail, but what I can do is to, outline how the Irish, Italian, and Dutch experiences confirm or challenge these assumptions. So, first of all, I would say that the Irish and Italian experiences show how attempts at more standardized and lower damages for minor injuries may be actually quite quick, a matter of a couple of years in both cases, basically. In this respect, we see in these experiences, we see a confirmation that the insurance industry can be quite effective in influencing legislative decision-making processes. But at the same time, lawyers, judges, and somehow consumer representatives in Ireland actually contributed to these efforts. And in Italy, they didn't really oppose this effort, which may signal a potential convergence of interest, actually, in more predictable and standardized compensation for cases that have a quite low value. So a convergence of interest across insurers, lawyers, judges, and so on. And this finds some potential confirmation in the fact that Dutch judges were, since the beginning, very positive about the very standardized system proposed by the Dutch lawmaker regarding bereavement damages. Things, however, change completely when we turn to damages for major injuries. In Italy, governments have failed so far to adopt a table on the non-pecuniary damages for major injuries from traffic accidents. This this failure to act has been dragging on for 20 years now. So this shows how, the insurance industry is not all powerful, and other interest groups can effectively react against undesired reforms. And interestingly, a first draft table was proposed by the Italian government in around 2011 with drastically lower damages compared to the judicial table. and a bipartisan majority in the parliament, well, reacted very, very badly in respect of this proposal, approving a motion to urge the government to withdraw the draft because it was just too low, thank you, in terms of damages. So this also shows how policymakers don't really want to give the impression to the public that they are puppets of one particular interest group over the other. They want to present themselves as trying to decide what is actually best for society. And this puts some constraints on some lobbying initiatives and their success. So since I have less than 1 minute, I will just conclude. So I think that, well, this exercise is, of course, a first step. It's a work in progress. But I think that this kind of empirically oriented analysis informed by other disciplines other than the law, like public choice theory, can help understand how the law is actually shaped by interest groups to understand to what extent the law is connected or disconnected from the public interest and make proposals for interventions to make sure that the law and the public interest go more hand in hand. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for this extremely interesting intervention. Personally, I must say that I'm not a big fan of tariffication, but this could be a subject of discussion at another moment. Let's pass now to Hélène Guizou.
Guizou, yeah.
From the Université de Paris-Panthéon-Assas.
Thank you very much. So I'm very grateful to the Institute of European and Comparative Private Law for giving me the opportunity to participate in this symposium and to listen to all these inspiring contributions. I will briefly present a reflection on the coordination of the different compensation mechanisms that are called upon to provide a response to personal injury. Civil liability is often presented to French law students as an isolated topic, for theoretical reasons, of course, because it's part of the law of obligations. Liability is therefore considered in terms of its source rather than through its objective. But also, above all, for historical reasons, because in 1804, civil liability was the only way for someone who had suffered a personal injury to seek and obtain compensation. However, since then, and more specifically since the middle of the 20th century, other compensation mechanisms have been created and developed. This diversification is particularly evident in the compensation of personal injuries, which is so costly and so crucial that civil liability could not bear it on its own. Insurance has often supported liability. Social Security has competed with it. Compensation funds have filled its gaps, and social assistance has grown alongside it. In concrete terms, it means that if you are injured, you may have to turn to each of these actors to get different kinds of compensation. Unfortunately, despite these significant evolutions, the French legislator has never adopted a comprehensive approach to compensation. The compensation system has been built stone by stone, but without a global vision. As a result, the relationship between the various mechanisms is only dealt with from a very technical point of view. A few provisions frame the right of recourse of the third-party payers, but they have remained largely unchanged for 40 years and completely unchanged for almost 20 years. In the light of these major developments of the French legal and social framework, can civil liability still be considered as an isolated island? Can it be easily and efficiently reformed in isolation without taking into account its complex relations with the other compensation mechanisms? First of all, I would like to outline some of the practical difficulties caused by this poor coordination of the compensation mechanisms. At the financial level, it is very clear that the overlap between the different mechanisms leads to a lack of efficiency. Each victim is entitled to obtain both damages through liability and benefits through social security or assistance. This leads to situations of duplication. In some cases, this duplication is to the detriment of the third-party payer. For example, social assistance benefits cannot give rise to recourse because public bodies are not considered to be third-party payers under French law. This means that in many cases, the ultimate burden of compensation falls on solidarity rather than on the insurance of the liable party. In other cases, victims receive double compensation. They receive full compensation for their pecuniary losses on the ground of liability, and they receive benefits from the social assistance institutions. These duplications should not be underestimated because the sums involved are considerable. For example, a person may be compensated for the full cost of care for the rest of his life by both social assistance and civil liability. And a disability allowance can be granted for life to a victim whose loss of salaries has already been fully compensated. In addition, the scope of the entire compensation system is expanding. On the one hand, the full compensation related to civil liability and some compensation funds has been steadily increasing. The heads of damage have multiplied and their assessed value has increased so that the amount of damages has significantly increased. Moreover, scientific progress has and will continue to make it easier to identify the causes of what we still see as environmental disease. As a result, these illnesses will become personal injuries and more victims will be entitled to full compensation. On the other hand, the scope of social security and assistance has also been steadily expanding. Thanks to medical advances, patients can benefit from innovative treatments, which are very promising and effective, but also very expensive. Furthermore, many patients survive serious conditions that leave them permanently disabled, and as a consequence, they are entitled to receive benefits from both social security and assistance. This expansion of compensation at both ends raises a common financial question. Almost all civil liability regimes are linked to insurance so that the cost of compensation is borne by the whole society. Strictly speaking, these are not public finances, but it is still financed by some kind of compulsory contributions paid by the whole social body. The elasticity of the collective capacity to contribute to the compensation system as a whole is not unlimited. Therefore, the different compensation mechanisms must be coordinated. Second of all, these practical difficulties reveal deeper issues at a theoretical level. The distinction between civil liability and social security used to be very clear. One aimed to shift the burden of compensating the victim's loss to the person who caused it, and the other one provided benefits that the society was ready to pay to the injured. However, the expansion of strict liability associated with liability insurance has blurred the distinction. On the ground of liability, compensation now almost always falls on a collective rather than on the tortfeasor himself. Moreover, this confusion also affects the definition of the explanatory principles of each mechanism. The designation of the tortfeasor used to be justified by the fact that he was the one that committed a fault, or that he was, by extension, the one that personally created the risk. In this context, civil liability performed a normative function in addition to compensation. Today, however, many risks are socialized, which means that they result from social life in itself rather than from a personal choice of the tortfeasor. Thus, as insurance made liability painless for the tortfeasor, liability is used as a means of shifting the burden of damages to the collective that created the risk, and sometimes the whole social body. Finally, the different mechanisms and the principle on which they are based are even more difficult to identify as they are interdependent. Strict liability depends on liability insurance. And most of the time, if liability for fault remains, it is only with the support of a compensation fund. In other words, the role of each actor in this complex system needs to be clearly defined. Having made these observations, how could this coordination be implemented? And are there avenues of reform to be back to our theme? I am convinced that the legislator should face these practical and theoretical issues. In order to resolve these difficulties, I think we could follow two different leads, a modest one, reasonable and probably easy to achieve, and a more ambitious one that could bring about a more profound coherence, but that would require deeper changes. The most reasonable option would imply reforming together with civil liability the provisions that frame its relations with other mechanisms. Specifically, all public entities that contribute to compensate the consequences of personal injuries, especially public, especially the ones that provide social assistance, should be entitled to a right of recourse. The right of recourse should then be facilitated in practice. Public entities should be able to recover immediately, which is not the case now, the sums, the benefits that they are required to provide. A deeper reflection on compensation could also argue for a more ambitious reform. Each compensation mechanism should be precisely defined and its explanatory principle clarified. In this way, each mechanism would be an instrument with a precise form and a determined function. And for each kind of harm and each type of loss, the right tool would be used to achieve a precise goal. The scope of civil liability should be reduced. Whenever the aim is to shift the burden of compensation to a collective, whenever the injury results from a socialized risk rather than from a fault, civil liability is not the good candidate for the compensation task. The role of social security could be expanded to guarantee the satisfaction of the essential needs of every injured, sick, or disabled person, and in order to guarantee a certain standard of living in the event of injury, direct insurance would be more adequate and equitable than the use of civil liability associated to liability insurance. To conclude, I hope that these financial arguments could convince the legislator to do the reform and to adopt a comprehensive approach. But I think in a few days, we will obviously and unfortunately see in France what are the priorities of the legislator.